Okay, let's move on to page 72. And we have new readers. And we have...
Hi, I'm Clarissa, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Clarissa.
My name is David, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, David. And we're going to get into action now, and we're going to read about step 5. And we'll start with Clarissa. Have you made our personal inventory?
Having made our personal inventory, what shall we do about it? We have been trying to get a new attitude, a new relationship with our Creator, and to discover the obstacles in our path. We have admitted certain defects. We have ascertained in a rough way what the trouble is. We have put our finger on the weak items in our personal inventory. Now these are about to be cast out. This requires action on our part, which when completed will mean that we have admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our defects. This brings us to the fifth step in the program of recovery mentioned in the preceding chapter.
Now, one thing I want to bring out that I know there's this other group that does inventory work, and they believe that they don't have to read anything of that inventory to their sponsor except for their defects of character because of this. But we're going to do some more reading why I believe we need to read our whole inventory to our sponsor. Okay, go ahead.
This is perhaps difficult, especially discussing our defects with another person. We think we have done well enough in admitting these things to ourselves. There is doubt about that. In actual practice, we usually find a solitary self-appraisal insufficient. Many of us thought it necessary to go much further. We will be more reconciled to discussing ourselves with another person when we see good reasons why we should do so. The best reason first, if we skip this vital step, we may not overcome drinking. Time after time, newcomers have tried to keep to themselves certain facts about their lives. Trying to avoid this humbling experience, they have turned to easier methods. Almost invariably, they got drunk. Having persevered well with the rest of the program, they wondered why they fell. We think the reason is that they never completed their house cleaning. They took inventory all right, but hung on to some of the worst items in stock. They only thought they had lost their egoism and fear. They only thought they had humbled themselves. But they had not learned enough of humility, fearlessness, and honesty in the sense we find it necessary until they told someone else all of their life story.
Okay, so this is what tells me that I need to share a little more than just my defects with my sponsor. As it tells that my sponsor is really supposed to know, or whoever you choose to share your inventory with. And basically, this book tells you that you can share your inventory with a priest or a psychiatrist. But remember, they basically, in those days, a lot of them, most of them, shared their inventories with their sponsor. But when they wrote this book, they wrote this book to go out into a world where there was no one to ask to be a sponsor. So they highly suggested you could share it with a priest or a psychiatrist. So this says that they need to know your whole life story. And then also, back here in the paragraph where it just said, in actual practice, we usually find a solitary self-appraisal insufficient. So we might need our sponsor to help us come up with those defects of character, to help pull those out of the inventory that we've just read to them. Okay, let's turn to page 75. Okay, when we decide, John, David, I just want to keep calling you John, I don't know why. You look like a John. When we decide.
I can't even talk about this.
Not exactly sure I should take that.
That was my husband. No, my husband said, I'm not even believing you did that one. I'm sorry. That was an honest mistake. I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah, so it didn't slip. Oh, God, I'm really embarrassed. Okay. All right. When we decide.
When we decide to hear the... Who is to hear our story, we waste no time. We have a written inventory, and we are prepared for a long time.
I wanted to say they didn't need the money. It was just, you know, I don't know if I ever experienced that, but I know that I have told some of my girls that, you know, if they don't want the money and you don't have it, later on when you do have it, find another way to give back. And just know that that's God's way of taking care of you at that time. You've made the amends. That's my personal opinion. And someday you'll give back as long as you stay sober in this program. Anybody who wants, you know what, let's go on and finish a little bit of reading, and then we'll open this up a little more about step 9, because this is a really important step, and we'll set up the microphone after we take our break for you guys to come up and either ask questions or tell us a little bit how you did step 9. Okay, but let's finish up just a little more reading on step 9, and it might answer some questions. Okay, whose turn is it to read?
Mine.
Okay.
Probably there are still some misgivings. As we look over the list of business acquaintances and friends we have hurt, we may feel
diffident
about going to some of them on a spiritual basis. Let us be reassured, to some people we need not and probably should not emphasize the spiritual feature of our approach, our first approach. We might prejudice them. At the moment, we are trying to put our lives in order, but this is not an end in itself. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us.
So highlight that or underline that in your book. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and to the people about us. And that's not saying just alcoholics. The people about us. Go ahead.
It is seldom wise to approach an individual who still smarts from our injustice to him and announce that we have gone religious. In the prize ring, this would be called leading with the chin. Why lay ourselves open to being branded fanatics or religious bores? We may kill a future opportunity to carry a beneficial message, but our man is sure to be impressed with a sincere desire to set right the wrong. He's going to be more interested in a demonstration of goodwill than in our talk of spiritual discoveries. We don't use this as an excuse for shying away from the subject of God when it will serve any good purpose. We are willing to announce our convictions with tact and common sense. The question of how to approach the man we hated will arise. It may be he has done us more harm than we have done him, and though we may have acquired a better attitude towards him, we are still not too keen about admitting our faults. Nevertheless, with a person we dislike, we take the bit in our teeth. It is harder to go to an enemy than a friend, but we find it much more beneficial to us. We go to him in a helpful and forgiving spirit, confessing our former ill feeling and expressing our regret. Under no condition do we criticize such a person or argue. Simply we tell him that we will never get over drinking until we have done our utmost to straighten out the past. We are there to sweep off our side of the street, realizing that nothing worthwhile can be accomplished until we do so, never trying to tell him what he should do. His faults are not discussed. We stick to our own. If our manner is calm, frank, and open, we will be gratified with the result. In 9 cases out of 10, the unexpected happens. Sometimes the man we are calling upon admits his own fault. So feuds of years standing melt away in an hour. Rarely do we fail to make satisfactory progress. Our former enemies sometimes praise what we are doing and wish us well. Occasionally they will offer assistance. It should not matter. However, if someone does throw us out of his office, we have made our demonstration, done our part. It's water over the dam.
That's my experience with my dad, is that they just kind of threw me out. But I did my part, and this is where it's telling us, but we make our amends to stay sober, and I'm obviously a demonstration of that because I stayed sober because I did my part. But on page 77 where it says we go to the man in a forgiving, we go to him in a helpful and forgiving spirit. Do you think that means if you don't forgive him that you don't make your amends until you forgive him? I know a lot of people who use that as a cop-out. My sponsor just said if you still don't have a forgiving spirit, you just pray, you just ask God to help you go to him with a forgiving spirit. That's what and to go in there just saying the prayer, God, please help me have a forgiving spirit, and just to do my part. And sometimes what happens is by the time you confess your faults, you disregard the other man's faults entirely. That's what this says. By the time you confess your faults, you have a forgiving spirit. Now, even if they throw you out of the office, there's something in you when you've cleaned up your side of the street that's just cleaned out. You know, and that forgiving spirit comes by taking a set of actions contrary to the way you feel. That's what my sponsor has pounded in my head, is taking a set of actions contrary to the way I feel. Okay, go back. And it's David's turn.
Most alcoholics owe money. We do not dodge our creditors. Telling them what we are trying to do, we make no bones about our drinking. They usually know it anyway, whether we think so or not. Nor are we afraid of disclosing our alcoholism on the theory it may cause financial harm. Approached in this way, the most ruthless creditor will sometimes surprise us. Arranging the best deal we can, we let these people know we are sorry. Our drinking has made us slow to pay. We must lose our fear of creditors no matter how far we have to go, for we are liable to drink if we are afraid to face them. Perhaps we have committed a criminal offense which might land us in jail if it were known to the authorities. We may be short in our accounts and unable to make good. We have already admitted this in our confidence to another person, but we are sure we would be imprisoned or lose our job if it were known. Maybe it's only a petty offense, such as padding the expense account. Most of us have done that sort of thing. Maybe we are divorced and have remarried but haven't kept up the alimony to number one. She is indignant about it and has a warrant out for our arrest. That's a common form of trouble, too. Although these reparations take innumerable forms, there are some general principles which we find guiding. Reminding ourselves that we have decided to go to any lengths to find a spiritual experience, we ask that we be given strength and direction to do the right thing, no matter what the personal consequences may be. We may lose our position or reputation or face jail, but we are willing. We have to be. We must not shrink at anything.
Okay, I want to tell you something about my sponsor's husband, Dave, who has a lot of years in this program. When it comes to somebody maybe going to somebody and making amends that might land them in jail, he really believes that's pretty stupid for us to stand up here and play attorney and just say, you have to do it, don't shrink. You know, he says we're not attorneys. First of all, get an attorney. You know, take those actions. You need to go back and clean up side of your side of the street, but get an attorney. You know, get representation and let him counsel you on the best way to do it. You know, and know that God's in charge, because, you know, you might be more of maximum use to God if you're not in jail, you know. So get counsel, and you need to be willing to address it, but get counsel, and don't just go blindly out there and do it. And I know some people that have had to go to jail because of their actions out there, and they were of maximum service in jail. I cannot tell you how many people came out of that jail working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and stayed permanently sober because of this person being incarcerated. And it's more than one person that has been incarcerated. And it turned out to be a good thing. I've seen the jails open up when they weren't supposed to and release sober people that had been working programs in prisons. I mean, weird quirks that happened, mistakes that opened the cells, and they were released to freedom when they should have been in jail for life or on death row. I mean, when you have really had that psychic change, the gates of hell open. You know, God can do anything. But if you can be of maximum service and more useful to God in prison, maybe you need to be in prison. You know, that's between you and your higher power. And good sponsorship. But I've seen it all. You know, in 20 years, I've seen it all. Okay, but I do recommend if you have anything that you're really afraid you're going to go to jail for, get a good attorney. You know, address it with your sponsor, but get an attorney. We are not attorneys here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, you might find an attorney in Alcoholics Anonymous. Actually, to be truthful, I know lots of attorneys in Alcoholics Anonymous. But separate the two. Okay. Did we read this usually, however, other people are involved?
Nope.
And this is a really important paragraph. I'll read this because then we're going to jump to the next page. Usually, however, when it says we have to, it says we may lose our position or reputation or face jail, but we must be willing. We have to be. We must not shrink at anything. Usually, however, other people are involved. Therefore, we are not to be hasty or foolish martyrs who would needlessly sacrifice others to save himself from the alcoholic pit. And that's what I sometimes see people do. I've seen them not want to shrink, run out there, do something, end up in jail, and then their wife and kids have no support. You know, we really need to do this. You know, there's an appropriate way to do it. Okay, before taking that drastic action, this is page 80. Let's jump to page 80. Before taking that drastic action, which might implicate other people, we secure their consent. If we have obtained permission, have consulted with others, ask God to help, and the drastic step is indicated, then we must not shrink. Jump down to the bottom of page 80. And David, you want to pick that up again? The chances are
that we have domestic troubles. Perhaps we are mixed up with women in a fashion we wouldn't care to have advertised. We doubt if, in this respect, alcoholics are fundamentally much worse than other people. But drinking does complicate sex relations in the home. After a few years with an alcoholic, a wife gets worn out, resentful, and uncommunicative. How could she be anything else? The husband begins to feel lonely and sorry for himself. He commences to look around in the nightclubs or their equivalent for something besides liquor. Perhaps he is having a secret and exciting affair with a girl who understands. In fairness, we must say that she may understand, but what are we going to do about a thing like that? A man so involved often feels very remorseful at times, especially if he is married to a loyal and courageous girl who has literally gone through hell for him. Whatever the situation, we usually have to do something about it. If we are sure our wife does not know, should we tell her? Not always, we think. If she knows in a general way that we have been wild, should we tell her in detail? Undoubtedly, we should admit our fault. She may insist on knowing all the particulars. She will want to know who the woman is and where she is. We feel we ought to say to her that we have no right to involve another person. We are sorry for what we have done, and God willing, it shall not be repeated. More than that, we cannot do. We have no right to go further. Though there may be justifiable exceptions, and though we wish to lay down no rule of any sort, we have often found this is the best course to take.
Okay, I don't think we even need to comment on this paragraph. I think it's real clear. It says it all. You want to comment on this paragraph? You got to come up here, or wait till after the break, okay? And then I'll set up a microphone, so mark it so you know to come up here and comment on it, because we'll talk about step nine. Okay. Clarissa, our design for living.
Our design for living is not a one-way street. It is as good for the wife as for the husband. If we can forget, so can she. It is better, however, that one does not needlessly name a person upon whom she can vent jealousy. Perhaps there are some cases where the utmost frankness is demanded. No outsider can appraise such an intimate situation. It may be that both will decide that the way of good sense and loving kindness is to let bygones be bygones. Each might pray about it, having the other one's happiness uppermost in mind. Keep it always in sight that we are dealing with the most terrible human emotion, jealousy. Good generalship may decide that the problem be attacked on the flank rather than risk a face-to-face combat. If we have no such complication, there is plenty we should do at home. Sometimes we hear an alcoholic say that the only thing he needs to do is to keep sober. Certainly he must keep sober, for there will be no home if he doesn't. But he is yet a long way from making good to the wife or parents whom for years he has so shockingly treated. Passing all understanding is the patient mothers and wives have had with alcoholics. Had this not been so, many of us would have no homes today, would perhaps be dead. The alcoholic is like a tornado roaring his way through the lives of others. Hearts are broken, sweet relationships are dead, affections have been uprooted, selfish and inconsiderate habits have kept the home in turmoil. We feel a man is unthinking when he says that sobriety is enough.
So if you have a highlighter or a pen, I want you to underline or highlight that. We feel a man is unthinking when he says that sobriety is enough. Okay, go ahead.
He is like the farmer who came up out of his cyclone cellar to find his home ruined. To his wife, he remarked, "Don't see anything the matter here, Ma. Ain't it grand the wind stopped blowing?" Yes, there's a long period of reconstruction ahead. We must take the lead. A remorseful mumbling that we are sorry won't fit the bill at all. We ought to sit down with the family and frankly analyze the past as we now see it, being very careful not to criticize them. Their defects may be glaring, but the chances are that our own actions are partly responsible. So we clean house with the family, asking each morning in meditation that our Creator show us the way of patience, tolerance, kindliness, and love.
And that's at the home, so highlight that. Okay, David, you want to take the next paragraph? Next two paragraphs.
The spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. Unless one's family expresses a desire to live upon spiritual principles, we think we ought not to urge them. We should not talk incessantly to them about spiritual matters. They will change in time. Our behavior will convince them more than our words. We must remember that 10 or 20 years of drunkenness would make a skeptic out of anyone. There may be some wrongs we can never fully right. We don't worry about them if we can honestly say to ourselves that we would right them if we could. Some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter, and there may be a valid reason for postponement in some cases. But we don't delay if it can be avoided. We should be sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble without being servile or scraping. As God's people, we stand on our feet. We don't crawl before anyone.
Okay, so if you have your highlighter, I want you to highlight that. But we don't delay if it can be avoided. We should be sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble without being servile or scraping. As God's people, we stand on our feet. We don't crawl before anyone. Okay, we're going to take a 10-minute break. And what we're going to do is I'm going to set up the microphone right here. So if anybody wants to ask a question, reword it. Okay, my name's Michael. I'm an alcoholic. Okay, so we're talking about step 9, and we're not going to do this for more than 15 minutes because we have a schedule to keep to this morning. So I'm going to stand up here, and if any of you want to talk about step 9, ask a question, or maybe share something, not too long, so we can keep it down to 15 minutes. Just kind of come up in this aisle, or if you're right up here, then I can get to you with this cord. I have a long cord. So does anybody, I know somebody in the back, come up here first. Here she is. Okay, this is John.
I'm Debbie John, an alcoholic. And it doesn't say in there how to make amends when you are the girl that understands.
Yep, that's true.
So what
you're saying is you were the one that they were going to in reality, let's get down to it. You slept with the husband of married. Yeah, you slept with. Okay, yeah, she slept with married men. The best thing to do is nothing. No, I think that falls. Yeah, just stick to your own. Yes. No, I think that kind of falls under the category when making amends would harm other people. You know, and so that falls under that category. And there are exceptions to that also. There really are. I mean, especially in this day and age, I mean, let's get real and honest. There's a lot of diseases going around. You know, and if you find that you might have a disease, and I have sponsored in these cases people that had diseases that had to go back and tell other people. And it did cause a lot of harm, but it would have caused more harm not to tell them. You know, and it was people with diseases that might have passed it on to a married man, passing it on to his wife. You know, this is serious stuff. So this is stuff you take with a sponsor. If it's not going to hurt anybody to go back and make that amends, you make it. If it is going to hurt, like telling a woman you're sorry you slept with her husband, that falls into the category of harming other people, so you would not make that amends. But if you did have something that you transmitted and you need to clean that up, you do need to go and clean that up. Okay. We have another question.
My question is, when you are setting up appointments to make amends, how much information do you disclose as to what your purpose is? Are you very generic about, I need to see you for a half an hour, or do you give a little information?
Oh, in just setting up the appointment?
How much of the reason why you're getting together with them do you disclose before you get?
Well, I guess that's all individual, and it depends on the person. I mean, you might need to tell them that you want to get together because there's some things that you... It's generic. If it's somebody that you always meet with, just meet with them. Tell them you need a half hour. If you need to say that the truth on the phone, that I really need to talk to you about some things because I'm trying to clean up the wreckage of my past and I need to discuss some things with you, go ahead and do it. And also with your sponsor, always talk to your sponsor because sometimes you need to get real specific about what you're making amends for, and sometimes you should not. Sometimes you should make generic amends. Sometimes it's more hurtful to sit there and say, I did this, I did that, I did this, I did that, I did this, I did that. They don't know about it, and it just crushes them. Sometimes it's better to make a generic amends and say, you know, I know I have done a lot of things in the past that have hurt you, and I am so sorry, and I'm going to, you know, try to be the best example today that I can be. And if they know something, they'll bring it up, you know, and then you can validate it, you know. But sometimes we had this one guy in Augusta, and Ted and I just cringed. This was at Christmas time. He wrote his wife this letter. She didn't know any of this stuff, And he brought it to the meeting, and he told everybody about this letter he wrote. That, I mean, he put every little thing he did, I mean, he got it all down there and put it in an envelope, and he was going to hand it to her. And if she wanted to discuss it, he would discuss it. And we got hold of him, and we said, we highly did not recommend that. You know, and he said, okay, this is what he did. And we didn't sponsor him. He was just talking about it. So then he wrote two letters. And the one letter, he said, you know, he really wanted to make amends for everything he ever did to hurt her. And then the other letter, she said to him, so he gave her the option, you know, both letters. If you want to know everything I ever did to hurt you, this is the letter. If you want this. So, of course, she read it, and it almost ended their marriage. You know, it was just, he really, really hurt her. You know, and that's very inappropriate, you know, and he was not... Well, actually, his sponsor was drinking the whole time. His sponsor, shortly after that. That's the kind of sponsorship he had. In fact, his sponsor ended up dying of cirrhosis of the liver just shortly after that. He fooled all of us. You know, he fooled all of us. His sponsor, I didn't. You know, but we tried to warn it off. And he is married today. You know, he is married today. But, I mean, he went through a couple of years of being separated and everything. It really caused a lot of damage that was not necessary. He deeply, deeply hurt this woman. And she didn't deserve it because she had really stood by him. Anybody else have a question? Come on up. Microphone. Start getting up. Do you have a question? Or you want to talk about an amend you made?
Yeah, hi, I'm Bob, and I'm an alcoholic. And I just wanted to say that in regard to financial amends, I went through a situation a few years ago where I had to close a business, do a reorganization, went through a lot of legal stuff. And one of the things that I found that was very helpful to me was that I contacted all the people that I owed money to ahead of them contacting me. Their greatest fear is that I'm going to run and duck out. They're not so concerned about getting everything right away. And my experience was that it was actually something that was pretty amazing in terms of the faith in human nature that I developed from watching these people having a lot of patience and giving me a lot of time to go through and make amends. And, you know, it says in the big book about making amends, we make the best deal we can. They came to me with stuff after years of just making small payments. In one case, I had a credit card that I owed $6,000 on, and they said, give us $2,000, we'll call it even, and we want you to keep the card. You know, that kind of thing happened to me. That happened to me to a point at a level of which I was in debt to almost $100,000, and it's now down to about $15,000. And it's happened almost invariably in every case like that. But the main thing was, if they said they were going to call me in a month, I'd say, I'll call you, you know, ahead of that. And it was because of that that they didn't worry. And I didn't have to worry. What it really comes down to is there's a tremendous amount of fear, and it says we burn energy needlessly because we don't contact these people. We don't know what's happening. It's better to know what's going on and be in a situation where they know, you know, and it worked out, you know, all the way around. Thanks.
Thank you. Perfect. Thank you. It talks about that, losing fear of our creditors.
Because it was so important, the financial amends thing, as he was talking about, we owed the IRS tens of thousands of dollars. And I've seen people run from their financial amends, and I've seen the insanity around that in sobriety. And all I can tell you is I'm really glad that they caught up to us in early sobriety, because we spent the first 5 years just trying to clean up the wreckage of our past. My husband was married before. His wife had run up the credit cards before they were divorced. It was in his name. We paid them. It was our financial credit that was in jeopardy, and it was something that we chose to let go of in order that we could get right with our creditors. So, I don't know. It really has given us the freedom to go on, and we can have a house, we can have credit cards, we can do different things because we took care of this and we didn't procrastinate about it. And then there was the other amends with my sister. I went to her with this particular list of things that I was going to make amends with her, and she said, well, that's all fine and dandy, but this is really how you hurt me. And from that point on, when I left her apartment that day, we made a commitment to one another that our relationship would be based on honesty, because I was always the angry person. She was a silent scorn person. So she had to work on getting it out, and I had to work on restraint. And so to this day, you know, 7 or 8 years later, we've just grown closer and closer because of that, I think.
Thank you. I'll get you in just a minute, okay?
My name is Ann, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Ann.
And I just wanted to pick up, Debbie and I know each other well, but I think the thing that I want to share is that in making my amends, that the thing I have found the most important is to really keep my ears open in making my amends, because as I have formulated an amend to make and have done a lot of work in preparing for that, it has not been uncommon for me to have the person to whom I'm making the amend then say to me, you know, I need to tell you that what you've just told me is not really what hurt me the most. Mm-hmm. And I have had the willingness, and thank goodness it's a God-given piece, I think, I'm sure, to be able to say, tell me what it is then that hurt you the most. And then I've learned something that I just didn't have any idea about. And so that my amend was often not really the amend to make, that there was so much more.
Yeah, believe me, they'll tell you. They'll tell you. And sometimes it's good to also just say, what can I do to make this right? Yeah, what can I do to make this right? Come on up, honey.
Hi, I'm Joanne, and I'm an alcoholic. Just a couple of things. I had made an amend to a relative who I worked for, and I used to take checks and whatever, and I didn't...
Wait just a minute. Are you the one from Bangor?
No. And
I had a sponsor all picked out for you.
And I didn't really know how much I had taken. There were other things that I had taken, too, as well, drugs and whatever. And I had stolen business time to do my own personal stuff as well, but I had kept praying, and the amount of $2,000 kept coming up, and I just wasn't willing to give him $2,000. So then what I did was more praying, and the amount of $500 seemed reasonable. So when I went to make this amend to him, he said that he didn't want anything, that he was just happy that I was sober. And I had the $500 with me prepared to give it to him. He didn't want it, so I was, you know, this is good. The next day he called me. I found a scooter for my son. I can use a couple of that $500. And I gave it to him, but I was a little resentful, and I felt really bad about it, you know, because I was all set to keep my money. But, you know, and I gave it, and you know, my family has always been there for me. I've always been very lucky in that situation. And there's one other thing that, like, you said that people will let you know what you've done to them. Like, what about when they think you have done this certain thing and you really want to avoid a confrontation that you didn't do this thing and they're just insisting that you did? You just let them believe that, yeah, I did it, and, you know, what can I do to make it right, like you just said? Like, do you let them believe something that is untrue, or do you just kind of let it go because you don't have any control over people and what they think? Or, you know, are you adamant about, like, I didn't do this, I'm here to make the amend for this, this, and this? Or do you let them, you know what I mean? Do you know what I mean?
There's sometimes you can't change their mind, but I'm certainly not going to sit there and take responsibility for something I didn't do. However, I have learned to say you could be right. You know, maybe I was in a blackout. I have no memory. And if I did, I'm truly sorry. Come on up here.
I know that I spent my life going through my days. My name's Bob, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm part of the Moosehead Group in Massachusetts. I spent my life going through other people's lives and putting little black things inside of them that kind of made it difficult for them to trust anybody else. So maybe by going back and asking them, what do I have to do to make that right for you? So maybe I could turn that around and leave something that's a little different inside of them, change that little black thing that made it difficult for them to trust and believe, and leave them with something different that enables them to be a little bit open to other people and enables them to trust a little more. That's what my job is in these, and I don't know what I have to do for you to accomplish that. So you have to let me know, and I have to ask you.
Yeah, I think that's perfect. You know, just people that you just have that. He said that he's just left a little black hole in, you know, in their life, and to just go up to them and just, you know, say that, I'm truly sorry I hurt you. I don't know how to make this right. Tell me what I need to do. That's basically what you were saying. Is that what you're saying? Okay. And let's see what time it is. Okay. We're on a time schedule now. Okay, this is going to be the last one.
Hi, my name is Susan, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi.
A lot of the amends that I had to make were amends of omission. And I've heard other women who have directed me to this that I just was not there. And to be able to be there, to be the sister, the daughter, the friend that I can be today. And so, I mean, I did have to go and just do a generic amends in that respect. Another amends is that, you know, I worked in a lot of bars and managed a lot of bars, and I don't know how much money I took. I have absolutely no idea if it was thousands or not. I don't know. And I may never have memory of that, and I don't have the financial means to even start at this point to be approaching doing $10 and $5 things. But I can do volunteer work. You know, I can volunteer in soup kitchens. There are things that I can do to make living amends, you know, and that I don't live that way today. You know, a lot of my amends right now are, because I can't do the financial thing, is that I am there for you, and I don't choose to live that way today and to volunteer my time when I can do that. Whether it's in schools, you know, or whatever. You know, I am willing to do that.
Okay, and that again goes with, you know, God directing you to the kind of sponsorship that you need. That's probably, you know, the kind of, what she needs. I know my sponsor would not have let me do that. You know, if I could go up there and just say, I stole it and I'm willing to set up a payment schedule in the future, she would make me address that. But I truly believe this is, you know, you're guided to the right sponsorship. So in her case, I mean, it's none of our business how God takes care of you, you know. And I just know God's in charge. And some people have to make amends one way, and some people have to make amends another way. And we don't all make amends the same way. I mean, because that might not be what our soul needs, you know. God knows what our soul needs to get right with God, you know, to get right with this world and to get right with God. So, and this is where people work in programs different. We really need to, you know, cease fighting anybody or anything and practice love and tolerance. You know, everything is not the same for everybody. Everybody's needs are not the same. Everybody's amends are not the same. Everybody's actions out there aren't the same either. And it was cute when you said something about you weren't there by omission. I was always told that I was dishonest by omission. You know, it's the things I did not tell people that kept me dishonest. And I have to work on that today. I'm real good about it right now, but I have to work on it today a little bit with my husband. When it comes to my daughter, you know, I just don't tell him some things. I'm being dishonest by omission. But one thing I want to touch on real fast that has happened to me in sobriety. How many of you have wreckage of the present? Wreckage of the present. Financial wreckage of the present. And this wreckage that I have is really not of the present right now, but it's of sobriety. And what happened to me is, you know, when I was 4 years sober, I married another member of this program. And after we got married, and I want you to know, marriage is a serious commitment. It is a serious commitment, and if you guys aren't solid in your sobriety, it's scary. Because the man I married, he was 2 years sober. I was 4 years sober. He drank again, and he went out there and he did all those drinking things. We had picked up our lives, and we had new cars and we had new trucks. And he went and he crashed them all. And he didn't have a job, and everything fell on me, you know, because I'm the sober one, I'm the working one. I was responsible for absolutely everything he did out there, all the creditors, all the damage, everything. I was responsible for, and I had to take responsibility for it because we were married. So I divorced him as fast as I could to stop that. I didn't leave him. I just divorced him. But as a result of that, there was so much wreckage, and I was the only one working that I just couldn't do it. I could not pay all those bills. And we're talking doctor bills, crash trucks, cars, credit cards, everything. And I filed bankruptcy in sobriety. I had to file bankruptcy in sobriety, and I counseled. And that was the hardest thing that I ever did, because nobody worked as hard as I did to clean up the wreckage of my past. paying off every little thing that I ever owed or did. Nobody has worked as hard at it as I had. And so to file bankruptcy in sobriety was devastating. And I counseled, and my sponsor since has had to file bankruptcy. Her husband lost his job, which he had had for years and years and years, and they couldn't make mortgages, and things happened to them. And it was a dark period of her in her 20s. She's in 20-some-odd years, and this happened, and they had to file bankruptcy. And it was very devastating. And, you know, I don't know where that story ends yet. You know, I don't know where that story ends yet. I know at the time I had to do it, and I counseled with people in AA, and they said that they make laws to help people, and just because I'm an alcoholic doesn't mean I'm not entitled to this help. And but I still have that icky feeling about it, you know. And so someday when I'm able to, I would like to go back and try and make amends for that. And I don't know how much it is, $13,000, $17,000, something like that. I paid as much as I could, as long as I could. I never missed a payment or missed doing something up until the moment I filed. You know, I was just sinking, though. And I'm remarried to a wonderful man, and he's not responsible for that. You know, and I have my own business now, and if my business ever gets off the ground and ever starts making money, because it's just 2 years old and, you know, it's just getting going, then maybe I'll go back and approach those creditors. And I really liked what you shared about that. You know, even though I don't have to, it's wiped slate off the clean. In fact, it's been 10 years. It won't even show up on my credit checks. Now, this year, I think everything goes off my credit checks because it's been 10 years. I know when I financially have the resources that I want to go back and make that right. That's just for me personally. But anyway, so those are some of the things, you know, that we go through in sobriety. You know, and it's really devastating when we feel like we've worked so hard to be, you know, financially right with the world. But that's just my own stuff. But I'm willing. You know, I'm really willing to do the right thing with that when I have my own resources. Okay, we're going to get into reading the promises. And if you've noticed that the promises come after step 9, and we need two more readers. Come on up, the two that raise their hand, back there and up here. I'm not going to call you John, I promise. Probably your real name. Yeah. I've got books. Yeah, I've got books that are all marked. Okay, everybody open your book to page 83. Okay, and what is your name?
Alec.
Okay, read into the mic. Make sure you're talking to the microphone.
My name's Alec. I'm an alcoholic.
Okay, and what is your name?
I'm a drunk. My name's Ray.
Ray. Okay, so we have Alex and Ray, and they're real alcoholics, and Alex is going to start off reading If We Are Painstaking.
If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them.
Okay, this brings us to step 10, and we'll have Ray start reading step 10. And I want you, when you're reading this, to look at it, and when we get into reading step 11, I want you to notice how in the big book steps 10, 11, and 12 are really commingled. Okay, go ahead, Ray.
This thought brings us to step 10, which suggests we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. We vigorously commenced this way of living as we cleaned up the past. We have entered the world of the spirit. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for our lifetime. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. We discuss them with someone immediately and make amends quickly if we have harmed anyone. Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Love and tolerance of others is our code.
Okay, so if you have your highlighter, I want you to highlight that. Love and tolerance is our code. And I have to do that when I'm driving, anytime I'm angry, anything. I'm always reminding myself, love and tolerance is our code. And we really need to practice that here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Instead of judging other people and judging their programs and where they are on their path, we need to practice love and tolerance, or I need to practice love and tolerance in this program. In fact, I have become, that has become something for me that I do quite well. You know, I learned about being judgmental about people in this program, or being judgmental in general. I ended up walking in their shoes, experiencing their experience to get over the judgment. You know, and that is a heavy price to pay. And, you know, I'm not willing to do it today because I have paid some heavy prices. And so this is almost a mantra for me. Love and tolerance of others is our code. Now, can you see this paragraph? It's telling you actually step 10 is a 4 through 12. I mean, it's even telling us to go out there and try and work with others. It's really a step 12. Okay, and this, what we're going to read now, is called the second set of promises. I don't know if any of you have ever heard this referred to, a second set of promises, but this is referred to the second set of promises, and this is really a powerful paragraph. You want to take this one, Alex? And we have ceased fighting.
And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol.
Okay, highlight that. Even alcohol. But we have ceased fighting anything or anyone. That's a whole lot. That's a whole lot. The last thing is alcohol. We cease fighting anyone or anything, even alcohol. Okay, go ahead.
For by this time, sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we will find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we had been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor we are afraid. Are we afraid? That is our experience. That is how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition.
Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about, I'm going to share a story with you about being in fit spiritual condition. How very important it is for us to stay in fit spiritual condition. When I was 10 years sober, everything in my life was perfect. I mean, it was absolutely perfect as far as outside goes. I mean, I finally had an education. I was business manager of this major musical corporation. I had a brand new car. I lived in a nice place. I mean, everything basically was perfect. I was going to school. And as business manager of this corporation, I had to go to a birthday party. And this was to represent my company. And this was a birthday party for Debbie Reynolds. Now, today, everyone in program so young, they don't have a clue who Debbie Reynolds is. So they're not the least bit impressed. I used to stand up here and I was so impressed saying Debbie Reynolds, and they just look at you blank, you know, like, big deal. But when I was a little girl, Debbie Reynolds was a huge star, you know, and she was just my favorite star. She was one of those innocent little people that I just wanted to be, you know. She's just a huge star, and I was just so impressed with myself going to her 57th birthday party. And as I said, everything in my life was perfect, and I almost took a drink. I almost took a drink. And the reason why I almost took a drink, I was not in fit spiritual condition. This says I'll be placed in a position of neutrality if I'm in fit spiritual condition. In the first place, I hadn't been to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in over 2 weeks because I am much too busy growing in the business world. And I'm not working with any other alcoholics because I'm just much too busy going to school and working in the business world. So I started getting into that stinking thinking. And I started thinking thoughts like, well, maybe now that I have this very impressive job. I'm sitting there with all these social drinkers. You know, no one's drunk. They're all social drinking. I'm thinking, maybe now that I have this very impressive job and I drive a brand new car, I have an education. I'm not that little girl from the other side of the track that used to sleep in cars. Maybe I'm really not an alcoholic. Mm. And thank God I didn't act on it that night, because one very healthy thing that I have always done for myself is I do not have anonymity at work. Everybody at work knew I was sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had enough respect for this program that I didn't want to embarrass it by drinking in front of my coworkers. So I put it off that night. I decided I was going to try taking a drink the next day. But I think anybody who had worked these steps as hard as I had worked these steps, God had a chance to intervene. Because the next day, I was asked to pay a 12-step call on a makeup artist. This man was held up in a motel. He hadn't shown up at work for over 2 weeks, and the motel was trying to get him out. So they called his place of employment, and my executive director approached me and asked me to go see what I could do. I was really resentful because it really did interfere with my plans. But I called another alcoholic, a male alcoholic in the program, and I went trudging over to this this sleazy motel. He's in a sleazy motel, and you know, we have met, we knew each other just a little bit, and I knocked on his door, and I just identified myself. I just said, I'm Michael, and I'm an alcoholic, you know, and for some reason, he answered the door. Now, if that had been me held up, I wouldn't have answered the door, but he answered the door, and I stood there speechless because I didn't recognize him, and he was a makeup artist, and he had all this blonde wavy hair. He's standing in front of me now, and he's bald-headed, and he's huge. He's bloated from all that alcohol. He's bleeding from head to toe because he kept falling into objects. He smelled of urine, he smelled of alcohol, and he smelled of vomit. And I stood there speechless just looking at him, and I had a spiritual experience. I had that inner voice talk to me, and it said, Michael, this is you. You are not like the people you were with last night. If you drink again, you're standing in front of a mirror. And that man doesn't know it, but he's the one who paid a 12-step call on me. Because that night I got my fanny into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I recommitted to this program. I go to more meetings than I've ever gone to. I work with more alcoholics than I've ever worked with, because I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that the longer I'm sober, the more I need meetings. The longer I'm sober, the easier it is for me to forget where I came from. I cannot believe how cunning, baffling, and powerful this disease is. And I can't stay sober today on what I did yesterday. I can only stay sober today on what I do today. Boy, I got emotional. I almost lost it, but. Okay, let's pick up with, it is easy to let up on our spiritual. I want to tell you something about the word trudging, because I said I trudged over. We talk a lot about trudging. You know, in the dictionaries back in 1938, 1939, meetings were different than they are now. Do you know what the definition of trudging was in a dictionary back then? Walking with purpose. Walking with purpose. It makes trudging not sound so bad. What were you going to say, Andy? He said to persistently walk a narrow and hazardous path. That was in the Oxford group. Thank you. I haven't read that. That's good. And then we're going to come to another word here, and it says it's easy to let up on our spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. What does laurels mean? Past accomplishments. To rest on our past accomplishments. Okay, whose turn is it to read? Ray, go ahead.
We are headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. We are not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. These are thoughts which must go with us constantly. We can exercise our will, power, along this line all we wish. It is the proper use of the will. Much has already been said about receiving strength, inspiration, and direction from him who has all knowledge and power. If we have carefully followed directions, we have begun to sense the flow of his spirit into us. To some extent, we have become God conscious. We have begun to develop this vital sixth sense. But we must go further, and that means more action.
Okay, so one thing I want to point up here, let's look up here where it says that we are headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. Put your finger on, we are never cured of alcoholism. So you don't lose that spot in that page. And then I want you to turn to the front of the book. And this is just because in the Augusta area, we have so much controversy about this. I mean, I stand up here and I identify myself, Michael, alcoholic, because I really don't care if he's fighting anyone or anything. But we have people in Alcoholics Anonymous in Augusta that stand up and say, I'm a recovered alcoholic. And it just, everyone just gets so upset. And I want you to read this, the very front of the book. Alcoholics Anonymous, and it says the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. So it's fine to say I'm a recovered alcoholic. We've recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. If you, the very front of the book. And then later on, you'll read on another page in the front of the book that we have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. But then we have to go back here to page 85 under step 10, and it says, we are never cured of alcoholism. We are never cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. So, I mean, it's just not a big deal if someone stands up there and says they're recovered, because right now, while they're in fit spiritual, you know, condition, they are. So I just don't get in that controversy, but I just wanted to point that out to you if you guys have a problem with people who stand up there and say they're recovered. Yes?
The word recover, if I put it into tripping and falling, I can recover from a fall.
I'd recover as far as saying she trips and she falls. She could recover from that fall, but that doesn't mean she's not going to fall again. So that's a good way to look at it. Okay, let's go on, and we're now at step 11, and is it Alex's turn? Okay, step 11.
Step 11 suggests prayer and meditation. We shouldn't be shy on this matter of prayer. Better men than we are using it constantly. It works if we have the proper attitude and work at it. It would be easy to be vague about this matter, yet we believe we can make some definite and valuable suggestions. When we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Do we owe an apology? Have we kept something to ourselves which should be discussed with another person at once? Were we kind and loving toward all? What could we have done better? Were we thinking of ourselves most of the time, or were we thinking of what we could do for others, of what we could pack into the stream of life? But we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, for that would diminish our usefulness to others. After making our review, we ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures should be taken.
Okay, so if you have your pen and your highlighter, I want you to highlight that we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, for that would diminish our usefulness to others. Now, can you see how this paragraph just reiterated what we just read in step 10? On watching for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. We just read it in step 10. And now, in step 11, it's telling you when to do it. When to look at it. If you go to that package I gave you, there should be a sheet in there on steps 10. See if I can find mine. You guys have it? It's just kind of, I don't have mine. See if you have it. All I did is I just took those things. This is can be, if you want to do a written inventory at night.
It's the last page in the packet.
It's the last page in the packet. No, those are the prayers. The last page, yes. Okay, so there's no page number on it. It says steps 10 and 11. And it looks like this. And it has question marks on it. Okay, so all this is it's all these things. This is what you can do. If you want to do a written inventory at night and, you know, a daily inventory at night on retiring, you can just go to bed at night, and when we retire at night, we constructively review our day. And it says not destructively. I mean, I just put that in parentheses. This is constructively. And we were talking, someone was talking earlier about assets in your fourth step. You know, and it doesn't say to look for the assets. It says to look for the things we want to get rid of. But this is where we can look for the assets. First of all, it says, were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, and afraid? Okay, so look at those things. And if you know that you've experienced any of those things in the day, write about it. And then it says, do we owe an apology? If you owe an apology, put down the name of the person you owe an apology to. Have we kept something to ourselves that we should discuss with another person at once? And so write that down. Okay, call my sponsor at a certain time and discuss this with them. Were we kind and loving toward all? If we were kind and loving toward all, write about it. You know, you're going to look for the good things too, not just the bad things. We're going to look for the good things if you were kind and loving towards all. If you're kind and loving towards most people, put that down. You know, so what could we have done better? Put it down. Were we thinking of ourselves most of the time? That's easy. Yes or no? Probably. Duh. Or were we thinking of what we could do for others and what we could pack into the mainstream of life? And, you know, sometimes I really need to acknowledge the things I'm doing right. If I listened to an inventory that day, or I went to a meeting and I greeted people, or I helped somebody on the street, or I went to the airport and helped somebody carry baggage, I put it down. You know, I'm supposed to be looking at the good and the bad. If I'm packing into the mainstream of life, I'm going to look at that too. I'm not just going to sit there and look at all the bad stuff about myself. That's not what this tells me to do. You know, so if I'm packing into the mainstream of life, I'm going to look at that too. This is a constructive view of our day. And then we've got this really, in big bold print for you, in case it's all negative, but we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, for that would diminish our usefulness to others. After making our review, we ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures need to be taken. And I think that is a very important sentence there, that to ask God what corrective measures need to be taken, which brings me to another story. I used to have a lot of things happen to me when I was 10 years sober. At 10 years of sobriety, I also started having major panic attacks when I drove a car. You know, and I mean, no wonder I'm not going to meetings or sponsoring. I mean, but anyway, I started having major panic attacks when I drove a car. So my answer was to, you know, I just stopped driving. The only place I could go was from work to home to a meeting, if I went to a meeting, but to work to home to a meeting. And I was sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I heard this woman sharing, and this is after, you know, after the Debbie Reynolds stuff, and I've got a new home group and all that stuff. But I'm sitting in a participation meeting, and there was a woman there that I never, ever saw before. And she sat there, and she was just in tears, and she said, God, it's so good to be in a meeting. She said that she hadn't been in a meeting in 2 years because she had been housebound. She hadn't walked out of her house in over 2 years because she had a thing called agoraphobia. And I never heard the word agoraphobia before. And she described her symptoms, how it started, and it started with having panic attacks in her car. And then she stopped going places, and her world got real, real small, where she wouldn't leave the city, then she wouldn't, she ended up housebound. And when she said that, it was just like a spiritual experience that that's what was happening to me, that I was going to be housebound if I didn't do something about it. And, you know, it just never occurred to me until I sat in that meeting. And so I went home, and I wrote about my panic attacks in my car. I listed it on step six. I called my sponsor, and I shared it with her, and we said the seventh step prayer together, asking God to remove this. And then my sponsor gave me corrective measures to take. She had me get on the freeway the very first day, the very next day, and get off on the very first exit. She had me get on the freeway the second day and get off on the second exit. She had me get on the freeway the third day and get off on the third exit. And it's so funny, when you're really willing to turn your will and your life over to God, the things that happened to me in that small amount of time. Because I never got up at a podium and even talked to people or shared my story till I was 11 years sober, because I had a phobia of people. I would get up here, my knees would shake, and I would almost throw up. And at that point, when I'm really turning my will and my life over to God, I'm asking God to remove these panic attacks. I'm asking God to just help me to be out there and get out there in the world. Things started happening to me. That's when I ended up having to start speaking. I had to go share at a meeting in my sponsor's place because she was sick. She made me go in her place. And from that meeting, I was asked to speak at three other meetings. And then one of those meetings was taped. And somebody sent my tape to a taper like Jill and Jerry, and so that paper sent it to conventions, you know. And so I'm getting invited to speak in cities that I have to drive 2 hours to, and this is terror. You know, I mean, I'm up here sick. It was just terror for me to be up here in the first place, and now I got to drive 2 hours. And so I packed my car full of AA people, and they would go with me, you know. And then the time came, you know, because I could drive a little bit by myself, but I still couldn't go that far by myself. And then the time came where I had to make this long drive, and no one could go with me, and it had to be just me and God. And it was either not keep an AA commitment or to walk through the fear. You know, and I did. I just hyperventilated the whole way, and I ended up, I got there, and I shared my story, and I got home. And then I'll be damned if I didn't get a phone call to go speak at a conference where I had to get on an airplane. And I'm going, oh, my God, you know, this is, you know, I just thought, this is not fair, you know, that this is not fair. Now I got to get on an airplane. You know, my sponsor, she realized I had this phobia, but she didn't know quite how serious it was, because when I started telling her about the fear of flying and all this stuff, she says, just get over it. You know, and I'm going, oh, okay, just get over it, just get over it, you know. But anyway, so, I mean, it just happened for me. When I went to that first convention that I had to speak at, I had a lady that was going to take me to the airport, and she was going to walk me in there, and she was going to talk to me, and she was going to kind of boot me on the plane. And, you know, as these emergencies happen, an emergency came up, and she took me to the airport, but she had to just leave me because of an emergency with her kids. She just dropped me off, you know, and I'm at LAX airport, in my fear, and I'm in stark terror, and I sat there, and I'm looking at all the airplanes, and I'm looking at all the people, and I mean, everything is just, I just can't even tell you how cluttered things got, you know. And I started to hyperventilate, and I couldn't breathe. And I finally sat down in a chair, and I just started crying, and I just knew I wasn't going to get on that plane. I was not going to get on that plane. And I had that inner voice again, and it said, Michael, get out of yourself and try and find somebody to help. And it was just like I just came to, you know, and I ran to the I ran around the airport, and I started, there's a big old escalator, and there's these little ladies struggling with their baggage, and so I started helping these ladies up the escalator with their baggage. I had a fight with a couple ladies trying to get their bags from them. This one lady, I mean, I scared them, you know, I scared them. This one lady, she desperately needed help. This was on the ride home or maybe another flight, and she couldn't get there. She couldn't hardly walk, and so I got her in one of those buses, and we got her to the other side, and I got her loaded up because I had a long layover. And afterwards, you know, and I'm just feeling so good that I'm doing all this stuff. And afterwards, I accidentally hugged her. And she goes, God, you guys are friendly here, aren't you? But that's the kind of stuff that helped me start walking through that fear. You know, that's the kind of stuff that helped me start walking through that fear. And I'm telling you, my life is so different. My world is so big. There's no way I would have met the man of my dreams if I hadn't been willing to get on an airplane and walk through fear. I wouldn't have all of you friends. This is one of the best weekends I've had. You guys have been so much fun. And I just wouldn't have these experiences if I wasn't willing to walk through this fear. And I still have it. It's still hard for me to get on an airplane, but not like it was. I don't hyperventilate. I don't have a panic attack. If I feel my heart pounding, the first thing I do is look for somebody I can help. And if I'm sitting in that plane and we're in turbulence, I start praying for other people. And I just know walking through fear is exercising faith. And there's a whole world out there when you're really willing to walk through that fear. So that's what came to me over corrective measures. Okay. On awakening.
Let us think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for the day. Before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking, especially asking that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. Under these conditions, we can employ our mental faculties with assurance, for after all, God gave us brains to use. Our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. In thinking about our day, we may face indecision. We may not be able to determine which course to take. Here we ask God for inspiration, an intuitive thought or a decision. We relax and take it easy. We don't struggle. We are often surprised how the right answers come after we have tried this for a while. What used to be the hunch or the occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind. Being still and experienced and having just made conscious contact with God, it is not probable that we are going to be inspired at all times. We might pay for this presumption and all sorts of absurd actions and ideas.
Okay, that first marriage of mine in sobriety falls under this category. Because I really thought I was inspired, you know, that this was God's will for me. And I'm telling you, when I was approaching this marriage with Ted, boy, I just got on my knees. And it was for the first time I was really willing. I just said, God, if this isn't right, I don't want to do it. You know, I just don't want to do it. And that's not my pattern. My pattern is just a, you know, get in there and do it if it's my will whatsoever. As much as I loved him, I just knew I just didn't want to make any more mistakes. I didn't want to pay any more of those consequences. You know, and it was really that I can always manipulate a prayer. Somehow I can manipulate that prayer to work so I can just line my will up with God's will when I'm really trying to line God's up with my will. But I have a great way of manipulating that. Not so much today, but that's what I used to do. And I have paid many consequences, many consequences. Okay.
Nevertheless, we find that our thinking will, as time passes, be more and more on the plane of inspiration. We come to rely upon it. We usually conclude the period of meditation with a prayer that we be shown all through the day what our next step is to be, that we be given whatever we need to take care of such problems. We ask especially for freedom from self-will and are careful to make no request for ourselves only. We may ask for ourselves, however, if others will be helped. We are careful never to pray for our own selfish ends. Many of us have wasted a lot of time doing that, and it doesn't work. You can easily see why. And if circumstances warrant, we ask our wives or friends to join us in morning meditation. If we belong to a religious denomination, which requires a definite morning devotion, we attend to this also. If not members of religious bodies, we sometimes select and memorize a few set prayers which emphasize the principles we have been discussing. There are many helpful books also. Suggestions about these may be obtained from one's priest, minister, or rabbi. Be quick to see where religious people are right.
make use of what they have to offer.
Okay, so this is telling us that if we belong to a religious denomination, see to it. You know, one thing about in California, people put down churches and religion a lot. You know, where I came from in AA there, that this is their church. And that's fine. That's fine. In the South, though, it's totally different. People are very religious in the South. It's been a whole new experience for me. And this book says if we have a religion and we want to go back to church, see to it. See to it where these people are right. And then if this is where your God is, that's fine, too, because this is where my God is. I've tried churches and I've tried all that. And my daughter's now just joined a church, and I'll go to church with her to support her. But basically, this is it for me in AA. But if you have a strong religious affiliation, see to it. That's part of the 11th step in this book, and never apologize for that. You know, if that's part of your spiritual growth, never apologize for that. Go ahead. One thing I want to talk about right here where it says, if circumstance warrants, we ask our wives and friends to join us in morning meditation. You know what? I pray a lot with the people I sponsor. If I'm on a little retreat, and a bunch of us women are together, we pray a lot. A lot of the times when I go speak at a conference, the Al-Anon speaker or one of the speakers will grab me to go say the third step prayer before she talks, or I'll grab someone to say the third step prayer with me before I talk. But a lot of the time, and we used to do it a lot more often than we do now, we still do it, Ted and I still do it a lot, but we used to do it religiously every day. We got on our knees, my husband and I got on our knees every morning and said the third step prayer, the seventh step prayer. We prayed for God to direct our thinking. We prayed to be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, self-seeking motives. We prayed to know God's will and power to carry that out. And we always did that as a couple. And then I, in turn, would do a form of meditation where I would try to listen to God. And how many people here meditate? You try? Somebody said they try. How many people here don't have a clue how to meditate? They're like, you know, we're just going to try a little experiment here, okay? Let's just get really quiet. I'm just going to give you, this is for beginning meditations. There's all kinds of books, and we're only going to do this for 2 minutes or something. This is not going to take a lot of time. But this just might give you a clue if you have no idea how to meditate, or you can't still yourself to meditate. This just might just give you a little clue. And it's just one method of many, many methods. But this is the one that when I had a hard time learning how to meditate that somebody gave to me, and it really did help me. You know, and basically you just spend a minute telling yourself to just peace, be still, just quiet yourself down and put your body in a comfortable position. A lot of the time if I lay down, I end up falling asleep. So, I basically have to sit in a chair. And don't cross your legs. You don't want to stop the blood flow. Just relax your feet. Relax your arms, relax your neck, just kind of go from your neck, your head, your neck down, just kind of think about relaxing your whole body, and then just do some deep breathing. You know, just inhale, exhale, inhale, exhale. Now keep doing it at your own pace. On the exhale, say to yourself, let go. On the inhale, let God. Exhale, let go. Inhale, let God. Now just keep repeating that to yourself. Let's just give it 60 seconds. Exhaling, letting go, inhaling, letting God. Yourself back. And you might just thank God for all of your many blessings. You might thank God for your sobriety. If anything else went through your head that felt inspirational, you might write about it. And don't just jump up and run around, just kind of be at peace and come to. Now that you only did for 60 seconds. That wasn't so hard, was it? And you might, if you really got a sense of peace with it, you might just every day for a week do it for 60 seconds. Just till you can't do it anymore. Do it for, 2 minutes. Do it for 3 minutes. Do it for 5 minutes. Do it till you just start getting antsy. And then lots of things can come to you in that. And sometimes when you're meditating, if you're dealing with a character defect, like I have something that's really I'm dealing with, say fear. When I'm going let go, on the exhale, I'll say let go of fear. And let God on the inhale. And then I'll only say that word a couple times because I don't want to embed it in my brain. I'll just give it to God a couple times and then I'll go back to the let go and let God. Okay, so that's just a little form of meditation for anybody who's interested in the future. And there's lots of books, there's lots of ways that I'm not telling you that's how you have to do it. Please don't get me wrong. That's just a form, that's one way that helped me start learning how to meditate. Okay, whose turn is it to read? It's Alex's turn.
As we go through the day, we pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action. We constantly remind ourselves we are no longer running the show, humbly saying to ourselves many times each day, "Thy will be done." We are then in much less danger of excitement, fear, anger, worry, self-pity, or foolish decisions. We become much more efficient. We do not tire so easily, for we are not burning up energy foolishly as we did when we were trying to arrange life to suit ourselves. It works. It really does. We alcoholics are undisciplined, so we let God discipline us in the simple way we have just outlined. But this is not all. There is action and more action. Faith without works is dead. The next chapter is entirely devoted to step 12.
Okay, so let's see. What time is it? I know it's a great time.
10 of 11.
It's 10 minutes to 11? Okay, let's take a 10-minute break. And please, you learn a lot about yourself going through the steps, but this is my experience. I have learned a lot more, and I have grown a lot more by taking people through the steps. I have had so much revealed to me. And I know some people just keep going through the steps and keep going through the steps. And the answer is taking people through the steps. I know we need to do work. And another thing, you hear a lot of things. The thing that scares me is, one step a year. Oh, my God, I've never read that here in the big book. And I've never read burn your inventory, and I've never read don't burn your inventory. There's a lot of things you hear that, they're not in the big book. So, I just don't make a big deal out of it. But anything I've learned in the big book is that we don't avoid taking the steps, And like Dr. Paul always said to me, if you take the steps too soon and you miss stuff, fine, do them again. We're going to be doing the steps our whole life anyway, in reality, if you really want to think about it. But you can do the steps too late. There's a lot of people who avoid taking the steps or don't take them quick enough and they go back out and they drink. Some people die, some people make it back. And I know for me, if I hadn't taken the steps right away, I would have drank. I could not deal with that, the feelings I had about being a thief and the prostitution. And then I know other people who get active in other ways. As I told you earlier, my husband got active. He got really active in other things. He couldn't take the steps until he was about 5 years. And he still stayed sober because he got really active. But, so different things work for different people. And I just sit there and when I hear this stuff, and, even though I cringe when I hear a step a year, I lied. I am judgmental. I'm sorry. I don't think I'm going to get over that one. That's really rough. That means you're not going to be helping another alcoholic till you're 12 years sober. That's really scary. Talk about the grace of God. That would really be some grace. Just all into self for 12 years. Oh, that just terrifies me for myself anyway. So we're going to get into the chapter of working with others. And I encourage people to read about the history of AA. Read some of the books to read. Is Pass It On, AA Comes of Age, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. Some of this stuff really comes together, when you read about the history. And God, to me, has been revealed to me in reading about the history. So I encourage people to do that. I first get through the steps, be working with others, and then get into reading about the history. You're just going to feel a part of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you're going to feel like you're really part of that the sunlight of the Spirit. It's just The history is just awesome. Okay, so let's turn to page 89.